As we set our intentions for 2025, consider making a gift to support Berkeley students as they pursue their dreams.
Every donation helps provide scholarships, enhance facilities, and bring world-class guest artists to campus.
Start the year off right by making a gift at berkeley.edu/giving. Your support can make a big impact. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Berkeley Alumni's Pass the Mic, where we pass the mic to you. My name is Jaquel Illy.
I am, I'm Patrick Farma, and if it wasn't for you guys, I would have called out today.
I thought you almost forgot your name for a second. I was like,
I'm getting there. Going into this, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do. My wife works at a hospital, so right after New Year's, I got the norovirus, and then we recovered from that, and then the following weekend, I got my daughter's fourth grade elementary school cold, so it's been a rough week.
You are going through
it. It's a rough 2025.
It's only the first month. Oh my gosh. Yes, 2025. We are here. Happy New Year to everyone out there listening. We hope that this year brings new blessings.
What's your cutoff for wishing Happy New Year?
I feel like you could say Happy New Year the entire January.
All of January?
And then once it's February, yeah, cut it off. So it's New Year, especially if it's the first time I've seen you. Happy New Year. You know, I just feel like that brings good vibes. How about you?
Larry David says that the cutoff is January 7th.
What? Yeah. A week?
Yeah.
Only a week? Do you agree?
I think that's fine.
Am I pushing it for a whole month of Happy New Year?
I'm sure there's a somewhere in between, you know. I don't know if you want Martin Luther King Day to be your line of demarcation, but somewhere in there.
Yes, that is fair. That is fair. But new month, new year, new me. You know, that's what people say. I don't know.
What do we got going on today?
Yeah, so today we have a special episode featuring the one and only Robert Kraft. Now, not the Robert Kraft from the NFL.
No. By the way, I'm mad at NFL Robert Kraft.
Absolutely mad at NFL Robert Kraft. Is it because of the same reason as me?
I think so, yeah. They should have given Gerard Mayo at least another year.
At least another year. Like, they play Gerard Mayo so bad.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know him personally, but I know that he is probably a great stand-up guy.
Seems like a good guy.
He didn't deserve that. Yeah.
We interviewed Robert last year at the LA brunch for season two. This year definitely has a different tone to it because of the fires going on out there. You know, every day around campus, people are talking about what's going on out there, asking questions. You know, we're trying to figure out how best we can help support the alumni community. There will be opportunities for the LA community to come together and hold space, and more immediately, if you go to berkeley.edu/alumni and go to the benefits and resources page, there's a document there of resources for the Los Angeles alumni community. But, you know, just everybody here is thinking of the community out there and following it very closely.
We understand that this is a time for us to come together. So we're thinking of you and our hearts go out to you. Okay, so as we mentioned, we have Robert Kraft for this episode. And who is Robert Kraft? Obviously, he's not the NFL man, but who is he?
Well, I emailed Robert earlier this week to see how he was doing with the fires, and he's been fortunate. Mm-hmm. I guess there were a couple close calls, but he's been doing well. The way I like to describe Robert is that he produced the soundtrack to your childhood. He started out in New York, and he was a singer, songwriter, performer. He got connected with LA, and then he did some music for TV, including the theme song to Who's the Boss. And I'm just a big TV theme song lover. I could probably sing any TV theme song from the 80s. Not today, but in general. He went on to produce music for Disney. He produced the music for DuckTales and Chippendales Rescue Rangers. Then he started working with Jim Henson Pictures and ultimately became the president of music for 20th Century Fox. another one of those ones where I definitely fanboyed out.
Yes.
Every movie or TV show or anything on his resume is basically like has been consumed by me. I can go real deep, and I think I caught him a couple times being like, how do you know that?
Yeah. Yes, you'll definitely hear those pieces in this episode where Patrick's like, hey, what about this one? And then they kind of like bond with it and sing the tune a little bit. And I'm just sitting there like, okay, like this is not my time, but I enjoy it. I enjoy it.
I interviewed Robert for an after school special years ago, either my first or second trip out to LA when I started at Berkeley. And, you know, he was just so great. And, you know, off camera, he was telling us stories and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I definitely wanted to, when we went back out, and just give him a microphone to kind of talk about what he thinks about the industry, what he thinks about pursuing a career. He's like us. He loves his job. So why would he ever stop?
He is a storyteller, which you will all be able to hear. It's so vivid. Just hearing his voice, like the way he tells a story, it's one to enjoy for sure. So here's the episode.
Where did your relationship with Berkeley start?
Oh, that's such a nice question. Such a fun question. I wanted to be a music major at the School of Polo and Mining across the Charles River from Berkeley. I went to Harvard, and it was not really my first choice. Hmm. But my brothers, when they found out I'd gotten into Harvard, said, you're going. So I went to Harvard and went right to the music department, and they weren't interested in what I was interested in, which was pop, rock, Black American music, jazz. I wanted to be a rock star. I knew about Berkeley because before I went to Harvard, I did the very first summer program at Berkeley, my junior year of high school summer, and I loved it. I loved it. I learned so much. And so here I am at Harvard, about to be what I decided to be, which was a visual studies major, which is the goofiest department at Harvard. But I went to take piano lessons at Berkeley, and I took from a guy named Ray Santisi, who was an awesome piano teacher. I was a terrible piano student, but my relationship with Berkeley increased. So I would go in the summers. I tried to take a film scoring course there, and I was bad at everything academic. But Berkeley was a lovely kind of, in some ways, complement to my Harvard education. Mm.
So after Harvard, what made you lead to the decision of being a professional recording artist?
Oh, that wasn't in doubt from the day I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, February 9th, 1964. I sat in my parents' bedroom in Princeton, New Jersey, saw the Beatles and Ed Sullivan, and my career was set. Mm. I was going to be either in the Beatles or start my own Beatles. I wanted to write songs and sing them like a Beatle. And I finished Harvard and went to New York City to get a record deal. Got an apartment, bought a piano for $600 in the Village, and had it put in my apartment. It was an upright, really funky upright, which I loved. And I sat down and started to write songs. For a minute, I collaborated with a friend from high school. We were a really weird pair. We were both day students at our high school. It was a boarding school. He was the Black scholarship kid from Trenton. I was the white, out-of-place hippie from Princeton in a very straight boarding school. And we bonded. And we were like in a band. And we were the two music guys who ran the Glee Club. We meet in New York after he goes to college and I go to college. And we start sort of a band together in New York. And we write songs. I kind of write them and he sings them. We call the band the Ivory Coast. For lots of reasons. He then quits the band right before we're about to have a big gig. And I go to a friend of mine who works at BMI and say, well, I guess that's the end of my music career. He goes, when's the gig? I said, it starts Wednesday at a club called Tramps in New York. And this was maybe the Friday before. And he says, did you write all the songs? I said, I wrote them, but Miles was the singer. He said, you sing the songs, you take the gig. So I went and played, and somebody heard me in that audience. It was a big record producer.
Ooh.
Karma, number one. Always keep making stuff and someone will hear it. You know, P.S., I ended up getting signed to a record deal, and it was now Robert Kraft and the Ivory Coast. And we made albums in New York City that didn't sell. I was on RSO Records, which was famous for having the Bee Gees and Eric Clapton. And it had the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. But it was, the record company went out of business. Then I was signed to RCA Records. And people don't realize in show business that most of what you do fails. So these records failed terribly. But people hear little things that keep you going. So on that third record on RCA, a producer in Los Angeles heard a song about New York that I'd written and asked me to come to LA and teach the kids on his TV show, Fame, this song. And I flew out to LA, taught the kids that song. He asked me to write the next song. Suddenly, I'm kind of writing TV songs in LA. And as they say in Hollywood, shit happened.
So as you talk about like songwriting, what inspired your early songs? Like what was that process like putting these songs together? Because you weren't singing them at first. And then it was suggested like, hey, maybe you should sing your own song. So
I think you said an interesting word before we started. I am a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And those songs were stories. Mm-hmm. One of them actually became a movie. The story of the song was made into a huge movie with a huge movie star. By the way, that movie failed. Mm-hmm. But I made Hudson Hawk with Bruce Willis. This is now 8 years after I'm in Hollywood doing songs for Fame, because I played my song Hudson Hawk for my friend Bruce, who was a bartender. And he said, someday I'm going to be a movie star and we're going to make this movie. And I said, yeah, man, you can hardly pay your rent. And I've been dropped by my third record label. But let's concentrate on realism. That was maybe 1980. I'd written the song Hudson Hawk in 1980 in New York about a criminal who they call the Hudson Hawk. I thought it was such a cool name for a crook. And in 1990, we were in Rome shooting Hudson Hawk for TriStar Pictures. Ridiculous, but if you listen to the end of the movie, because nobody saw the movie, so nobody's heard the end. But if you do listen to the end of the movie, Dr. John sings my song. Everybody knows when a cold wind blows, it's the Hudson Hawk again. That was my song. It was kind of a shuffle, and we got Dr. John to sing it. It was all cool. It just was too weird a movie. But when you said, what did I write songs about? I told stories and songs.
So when you get into LA and you're kind of working on these things, do you have kind of like a Jersey chip on your shoulder?
Oh, that's funny. I don't think I ever had a chip on my shoulder because I was so eager just to work. And I might have gone home after a meeting and said, oh man, that guy was lame. But in the meeting, I was always, yeah, sure, I could maybe try that. Thankfully, because I was asked to do several things that my initial thought was, this is so far from being that cool guy in New York writing those cool songs and being that artist who I desperately wanted to be, but that artist was going broke. Those records were not selling. And I was still 100% musical, but it was a little bit of, okay, I could continue to do this. I could be that guy and probably end up kind of crying in my beer 50 years later, being that guy in some little club. But in LA, they were saying, hey, could you write a TV theme song? Could you write a commercial? Could you score a movie? And kind of surprisingly, even to me, I would say, oh, I could try that. Mm-hmm. Even though it was so far away from my skill set, mm-hmm. my focus as an artist, because I was an artist, but hey, you know what they had that I didn't have? A paycheck.
Yeah. I remember when you you said when you were writing the theme song for Who's the Boss, you're thinking like white suburban and you just played all white keys.
That's exactly right. I was living in the Oakwood Garden Apartments on Barham Boulevard, which RCA, I'd come out to LA to make my third album with, I wanted Donald Fagen to produce it, and Steely Dan, and I knew him, and I absolutely love Steely Dan. I kind of wanted to be Steely Dan. I'd moved on from the Beatles. I just wanted to be Steely Dan Jr. And I actually asked Fagen to produce the record. And he said, oh, man, I'm not going to do that. But you know who should produce your record? Larry Carlton, the great guitar player. I went into the studio to meet Larry Carlton, where he was making a record called The Night Fly with Donald Fagen. And I went on a day that he was playing the song Ruby Baby and taking solos. And I sat there behind Fagen and watched Larry Carlton take solo after solo. And in some ways, I thought, yeah, this is cool. And in retrospect, it's like, that was gold.
Mm-hmm.
What an experience to be there in that room. Carlton mm-hmm. and I, hey, man, yeah, come out to L.A. and we'll make a record. So I made the record with Carlton while I was in L.A. staying at the Oakwood Garden Apartments, making this record with Larry. Somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody called me and said, would you be interested in making a demo of writing a theme song for this TV sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know from TV sitcoms. I am too cool for TV, that's for sure. I am too cool for sitcoms. I don't know about, of course, what do I say?
Yes.
And I have a little keyboard in my Oakwood Garden Apartments that I'd brought at the Guitar Center, and I go, I think that is lame. Square, not funky, not cool. And I call Larry because I say, we're not going to record today. I need to lay down a demo in your studio and I need your help to put it together. So we go up to the Carlton's and he helps me make a really good demo of my and I send it in and I don't hear anything for like 4 months.
Hi.
And it's sort of the show isn't really going to go and they're not sure. Thanks for playing. You know, here's $2,500. And I get a call in April. This was in the fall or whatever year that was, 83, I think. In April, they say, Who's the Boss is going to be a replacement series this spring on ABC. And it runs for 8 years.
Mm. Wow.
And I'm going all the way to the bank.
Right.
And still do.
I bet, yeah.
Who's the Boss is on, like, you get a royalty statement and it's on in Bulgaria. It's good to do those things.
Were you pushing for a Who's the Boss reboot?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's funny because one of the things that also, right, not long after that, I do Little Mermaid and produce that soundtrack, which is another incredible, ridiculous accident. But the reboots, which there have been all since I did it in 87. There's been a live action. There's been a Broadway. There's been a different, like a live TV night thing. Mm-hmm. Whenever they do the reboot version, somebody goes out and buys or streams the original soundtrack that I produced and it shows up.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I said yes to that one too.
Yeah. From hearing you talk, it's like clear that you have like this type of like attitude of always taking risks or being open to new things. Can you explain how that is important in the music industry to, you know, not just be stuck on one thing? Cause like you're saying, like, oh, this is corny. This is not cool. Like I'm used to my New York vibe and here you had to adjust for the LA kind of atmosphere. Can you just explain like that importance of just being ready?
It's nice the way you phrase that. I want to amend what you said to say it's important for me, but not important for everybody. And I really respect that. I know artists who are pure, directional, focused, creative artists And that's who they are. That's what they do. They don't care if they get paid. They don't care if they're successful. That's who they are and what they do. And I say, go. That's great. I wanted other things as much as I wanted to be that artist. And I'm terribly impatient. So I just wanted to be in. I wanted to be in it. I just, come on, I want to play. I want to be out on the playing field. And being the Robert Kraft image that I had in my head was keeping me kind of in a marginal place. It wasn't that it wasn't good or cool or I wasn't artistically fulfilled. I was all those things, but I wanted to adapt. I wanted to be included. And I didn't have a whole lot of pride about I'll only do this, which some people do. And I am so okay with that. I mean, if you think about what I eventually did, I eventually turned myself completely inside out. I ended up the executive at a movie studio in charge of the other musicians. That is the utter kind of either I collapsed completely or I converted whatever skills I had to get paid completely. But it's an interesting way to look back on a life and say, wow, you went about as far away from the initial sitting on a piano bench on the West Side writing cool songs, being out late at night, man. I'm a New York dude. Hi, how much are we going to pay for the license on the Neil Young song that's going into the movie that, guys, is Jennifer Lawrence, and she wants that song and we can't afford it. Oh, the director needs you too. And, Hans Zimmer wants how much to get paid? We gotta figure out our budget. I mean, that's a very far cry making those decisions and being in charge of that stuff. It's also was super cool to be able to pick up the phone and call Quincy and say, dude, what do I do here? Can you help me? Who should I meet? And it'd be, I can help with that movie. I can help with that TV series, but you should call Babyface. And hey, Sting, would you like to do a song in a movie? I never would have been doing that, which had its own great value. If I'd stayed on that piano bench. So there are pluses and minuses.
Absolutely.
And a lot of these decisions that you made, I think I have this thing too, where it's like, you love what you do. So you don't want to say no, because you always want to try and figure it out. But a lot of these things you talk about, like you would call them career killers. Like, oh, I'm working in kids' movies now. Did you ever get to a point where you felt like you were on terra firma?
Yes.
Yeah.
Once.
Really?
Fox.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Ironically, after just saying what a weird gig to be an executive at a movie studio after being, you know, all the way across the country, it was about as far away from being on 29 West 87th Street in New York in a one bedroom playing piano and hoping someone would hear me to being on the Fox studio lot every day in the executive office of the music building. That's exactly the opposite. But it was terra firma because at that point in my life, it was the culmination of everything I'd done. So even though I didn't have any idea how to read a music for film contract, how to run a department of 54 people, how to budget for songs that were licensing in a movie, I'd never done any of that. And I was the wrong guy in many ways for that gig when they hired me. They didn't know that, but I did. But the more I did it, the more I realized, oh, wait a minute. I've scored movies. So when I'm sitting there behind the composer and I hear something that the director says, I don't know if that works. And he'll pull me aside and say, it's too sad. I could go to the biggest composers on the planet and say, the A minor in measure 32, because by now I know that stuff.
Yeah.
Right over the girl kissing makes him sad, and he's embarrassed to tell you, the director, because he thinks you'll, you know, the weirdest conversation in the world with these composers. But I could look at the score. I could go out to the band and say, let's take 10. I knew how to do it because I'd done it. I'd had directors tell me stuff. I knew how to get songs written for movies. I knew how to talk to artists. I knew how to take phone calls in the middle of the night from artists who said, I think I'm the wrong person. Because I'd been that artist. And I'd say to Tom Petty, man, come on. You're Tom Petty.
Mm-hmm.
You can write this song, dude. Yeah, but I'm on tour and I don't know. I'm not really a movie guy. You should get somebody else. Everybody had that kind of insecurity, but mostly I had. So I could sit in that office and deal. And so those 20 years were Terra Firma. Before and after have always been up and down. And even that gig, by the end of it, I thought, really? Big Mama's House 11? That's my day job. I really dig doing Napoleon Dynamite and Waiting to Exhale and Avatar. Mm. And these movies were so interesting. Moulin Rouge. But there were also movies that are called programmers.
Mm.
Studios making 24 movies a year. Mm. You're doing 2 movies a month. Not all of them are 500 Days of Summer.
Mm-hmm.
Or Light It Up, Forrest Whitaker directing, Usher in his first role, you know, cool stuff.
So basically, you're describing like the play out of Goodfellas, basically.
That's funny.
You might think of like, okay, well, you are in the middle of, you know, the studio and the talent and stuff, but it's just, you're taken from all sides.
Absolutely. And sometimes one of the things that was most frustrating for me and still is finding out you can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
I was in charge. I wanted people to do what I thought should happen. You cannot. It is one of the most humbling things. And it's a fabulous rule for when any one of us bums out that something didn't work out, which is always.
All right.
You don't have a lot of control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people decide in the middle of an afternoon, I'm not going to do that. We have an agreement. Yeah, you know what? Here's what you can do with your agreement. That's why so little is successful, because the alchemy of getting everyone lined up in the same direction. And oh, by the way, it's good what you made. That's really rare.
Hmm.
Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit. I wanted to know more about like your transition from going from being a producer to starting to work in the Disney films. How was that?
My first job at Disney was writing the songs for a movie called Adventures in Babysitting, where they needed a blues song for Elizabeth Shue to sing in a bar. Albert Iceman Collins in the script says to the babysitter, nobody gets out of here without singing the blues. And
a babysitter.
And it's so hard babysitting these guys.
How do you know that?
Watched a lot of movies, Robert.
How do you know that? The scary thing is, I might have written that.
Oh, that's funny.
Lyric.
Life.
Because I said, well, that's, you know, what Albert Iceman Collins, first of all, talk about what the difference between being that guy on the piano bench in New York and ending up writing Hollywood songs. I never would have been flown to Chicago to go into a bar with Albert Iceman Collins, a legendary blues guitarist, and spend 2 days in a studio with him, teaching him and his band 2 songs, and then going to the movie set and being the kind of music guy in charge. I was a songwriter and I also was the producer of the songs. And you know what was really silly is, for all you songwriters out there, I had a really dumb idea that I played for the director and producer of the movie. Director was a guy named Chris Columbus, whose next movie I also did, and then called Heartbreak Hotel. And then his third movie after that, I said, I don't know, man. These movies are not really for me. Was Home Alone.
What?
One of the things that you miss in life. But I said to them, so she's going to sing a song. She's never sung in a blues bar. It's Albert Collins. It'd be something like, boo did or did him. You know, it's like the oldest blues trope in the world. But I mean, it wouldn't be that, because that's so obvious. And they said, we love that.
Yeah.
so I kind of took the basic blues riff of Life, that's 1,000 songs and twisted it a little bit so it's not total copyright infringement. But to answer your question, at Disney, I was writing songs. Then I was producing. At the end of Adventures in Babysitting, I think, was Expressway to Your Heart. I produced in New York. It might be that movie or another Disney movie. They started to bring me in to produce. And then I got the call from Bruce Willis, who I knew as a bartender, that he was on this television show called Moonlighting. He got offered a record deal. This is all old history. And he calls me and says, could you call the guy back who's president of the record label? I don't even know what to say. You've like done record deals. I've made records.
Yeah.
He said, well, will you produce it, Robert? I said, okay. I'd never produced a record. I'd been the artist on all my records. There was always a producer. Yes, I will. I produced the Bruce record. Record was kind of shaky, but Bruce was really famous. So we sold a lot of records. And that's when Disney called me and said, they have a big new project, which is taking a Hans Christian Andersen story called The Little Mermaid. Hmm. And the two guys who had written the songs had never really produced records. They'd been Broadway guys, Howard Ashman and Alan Menken. And they were coming to Burbank, where Disney is, to play their songs. And they needed them recorded. And they needed characters to sing them. And Robert, we know you from the... Listen, it turns out it was really great to have done, like, Chip and Dale, Rescue Rangers. You know, I did some little songs for Disney, and they knew me.
Can I ask a question? Yes. Were you part of the DuckTales theme song?
DuckTales, yes. I think I produced it.
Okay, can I ask you a question? Because this has always been something. It's, to me, it sounds like Hall & Oates. Dun, 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 dun. It's what so I funny. Want, you got that.
First of all, I don't think, and this is how lame I am, I don't think I wrote it. I think Michael Silvershire wrote it and I produced it, but that doesn't surprise me. And that's a really cool thing that you just caught. And that song I put in 500 Days of Summer. When I walk, ding, 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 and Joseph Gordon-Levitt walks down the street. And it's a really great scene. DuckTales and Chip and Dale, I think I was just the I don't think I wrote. I think it was just the producer. You know, like they'd have the song and I'd have to make a record of it to play. But Disney knew me. I mean, that's so Little Mermaid. It was like, well, we knew Kraft and he just produces Bruce Willis record. And could you come meet Ashman and Menken? And I remember, Career Killer is like, man, I'm going to end up being the Disney kids guy. Mm. I'm not going to be in Led Zeppelin at this rate.
Yeah.
But why did you look at it as a career killer, though? Like, why not be excited for the new opportunities that could be open from this position?
I think secretly, I was exactly what you just said. I think I was a career killer because I thought, well, this isn't cool. Mm. But this is really Hollywood. I'm really going far from, but secretly, they're giving me a budget to go into a recording studio with Sebastian the Crab and record Under the Sea. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
it's musical. And I love music. I love musicals. You know, I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, and I was in musical theater in the town. We did Gypsy and we did different shows. We did The King and I. And I grew up, my parents, we'd always go into New York City to see a new musical, Bye Bye Birdie. And in high school, I was in the musicals. So doing The Little Mermaid, a musical, as much as I wanted to be this cool nighttime New York guy, secretly or overtly, this was really, I can do this. Right. I got this. I love this stuff. Mm-hmm. The career killer might have been, does this take me farther and farther away from being an expressive, downbeat Tom Waits artist? Mm. Randy Newman, you know, those were the people I loved and admired. Donald Fagen, Steely Dan. Donald Fagen wasn't producing The Little Mermaid. He was making Steely Dan records, and that was my dream. But they were going to pay me to do Little Mermaid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were even going to give me a piece of the record.
Wow.
That was what producers got. You produce, you get a fee to produce, and they give you I didn't care about any of that, but it was like, oh, we're giving you some points on the record too. Okay, I guess. I don't know. It's like fantasy play money. P.S. I moved as a result of The Little Mermaid. Oh, yeah, we moved.
Yes. Did you see the more the newest Little Mermaid?
I saw a piece of it. I am kind of allergic to seeing other examples of something I worked really on. It's just weird.
Yeah. Ooh.
I see remakes are coming out of something I did, and it's like, I don't want to see it. It's never going to be what I...
Right.
So I haven't seen really any of the other Little Mermaids, and there have been two or three.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a lot of different versions of, I don't know, other movies I did or something where they remake them. It's not that interesting to me.
I've heard some people describe it as like seeing an ex.
Yeah.
It's like...
it's so funny. I don't
want to go there.
It's so funny. It's a song on my third album, Out With My Ex.
Mm.
We don't talk about anything too complex. We split the checks.
Hey.
We don't talk about things that lead to starting a family.
What keeps your passion going now? What are you working on these days?
I talk about the distance continuing between being that piano player. I came out of Fox with a very unpredictable new interest.
Hmm.
So I did the music for films, which meant I had to be the music guy on 306 movies.
Wow.
I counted everyone, and Life of Pi was number 306.
Mm. Wow.
I won the Academy Award for Best Score after I was told, this music is terrible. And I said, yeah, but I think it'll work. And that was kind of the end of the road for me.
Well, way to show them.
Yeah, I guess. You know, never want to be that person that says, told you so. But I sometimes say, I'm at the front of the told you so line. That's my way of saying, I kind of knew this was going to either work or tank. But it was impolite to say it. But I worked on all those movies, and I also worked on a lot of TV shows because Fox was making Simpsons and Family Guy and Ally McBeal, and they all had music. And I ended up coming out the other side of being a guy doing music for film, being convinced that there was a new opening in the culture for films about music.
Right, yeah.
And look where we are 10 years later. Every biopic. So I'm excited about a lot of projects I'm working on that are about musicians and musical moments because I'm very interested in, once again, doing something I don't really know how to do, which is produce the movie, not the music. Mm, we got the music. How do you make the whole movie?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm down that path pretty far, really far. Of figuring out how not to play checkers, but to play chess in a whole different arena of much more complicated situations than just making a record.
I also feel like knowing how to produce a movie, that title is played around a lot, you know?
Yes, mm-hmm. Correct.
And so it's like, what does a real producer do
correct.
Versus what someone whose name is attached to it?
Absolutely right. It's a very small part of being a record producer has that because I've seen some very famous record producers sitting out on the couch in the studio while the engineer made the choice. I mean, I was a producer who would like to put on headphones, stand in the middle of the band while they were doing the rhythm track or stand over the guy or play the part. I was really involved in the music. There are other record producers who are vibe producers. And the engineer's kind of in there doing it, and the record producer's on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that, but not as much. Record producers really are hands-on. Movie producers can be everything.
Right.
They can be the boyfriend of the producer who had the original idea and turned to his wife or his boyfriend, his husband, whoever, and said, you know, it'd be a cool movie, this story in the New York Times that I just read. They make that movie, he gets a producer credit.
Right.
You can also be someone like Frank Marshall, who is on every single item on the budget. Why do we need so much for transportation? This location is too expensive. We need to find another thing. Really producing.
Yeah.
I'm kind of obviously want to be understanding of how do you make the whole movie?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'll get there. I really don't. It's very hard. Each one I made this movie score, which is about film composers, but it really was, there was a director and some other people that really were filmmaking. And I brought to it, hey, I can call Alexander Desplat and I can call Danny Elfman and I can go to the studio with these people. And that was a role as a producer of being the knowledgeable one about the arena of film music. So there was a part for a producer, but the director really understood filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned from him about mixing and lighting, and that was a good start.
The other thing, I did think it is a trend throughout all the industries now, because one of the things that we have to do when Grammy nominations come and Grammy wins come is we have to go through that whole list to identify alumni. And the thing that has changed a lot is so many more names attached to these nominations, because if they pick a mix from a previous song, all the people that produce that are attached to the nomination for the new song. And so we've gone through, we have like a whole war room when the nominations come out now, because we need to go through so many different names.
Yeah, we're trying to make sure everyone gets their acknowledgement and their credit.
I understand what you just said at such a profound level, and I really appreciate learning that Berklee has to do this too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I consult with a couple music companies who have songs out there. I mean, Primary Wave has "And Devil," "Vivendinkabont," and "A Rebel." You know, Doja Cat. "I slang and instead, I'm going to be famous instead."
Hey.
But in that song, boom, boop, 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 walk on by, do, 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 do. That's a copyright of Burt Bacharach and Dionne Warwick. So there are a lot, and I know. And very super grateful to work with the people that work on the Burt Bacharach catalog and control it.
Wow.
And so those songs come out and get nominations. And is Burt Bacharach a nominee again? And Hal David, is Dionne Warwick a nominee again?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same issue. And I'm also...
That's a really good point.
We can end with this. I'm lucky enough to also be part of the music branch of the Academy Awards.
Right, yeah.
We go through an unbelievable process of trying to figure out who wrote songs. Because you get a lot of songs. I'll tell you what's really great. You get a Billie Eilish song, it's by Billy and Phineas.
Right.
Full stop. You get a Diane Warren song, it's by Diane Warren. You get a song from a number of movies, and there are 8 writers because they used 2 samples, and it's a great song and a big song in a movie, but the Academy Award will only go to 3 writers tops. You can't have 8 people come on stage. So you have to start saying who really wrote.
Wow.
Then you get a lot of fights from the other writers that say, I was in the room, man. The whole time.
You been at hours.
I was the 4th one. You can't. And once again, it's, you know, maybe do we have to bend a rule and say they're 4 this time? But what about numbers 5, 6, 7, and 8?
Right.
The sample. What are the, you know, so it's changing. It's one of the first things we talked about before the podcast started, which is the way music is changing. Music is always changing.
We are back. And that was our episode with Robert Kraft. What'd you think about it, boss?
I just like how open he is about telling stories. And, you know, I think he's at a point in his life where he can be like, I was the president of music at Fox. I don't have to worry about what stories I tell, you know, and it's, I think it's a lot of great insight, you know, just the politics of it all, and just coming from not that world and then navigating it. And I think that other thing about desire, about what do you want to be, you know, he was like, did I want to be that guy on the bench or did I want more? And he wanted more, but then that doesn't make him more successful than the person that wants to stay on the bench, you know? Everybody has their own journey. Everybody knows what they want to do and what they don't want to do. And he was able to see everything in front of him and be like, oh no, I want to be a part of this. I want to live and breathe this.
One of the things that kind of struck me was he always would downplay his accomplishments. Like, he was like, yeah, I did this score for, you know, The Little Mermaid. And I'm like, The Little Mermaid? Like, that's super iconic, you know? So just to hear him, like, kind of just be like, yeah, it's nothing, but it's so big. I think that that was really cool. And I also like, you know, like the themes of just like persevering. Like, at times he was talking about how he wasn't sure if he wanted to take on certain projects, right? He didn't think that they were cool mm-hmm. enough. But then, you know, they ended up opening up so many much more doors for him. And I feel like that's a really good like narrative that people can adapt to and just know that, you know, we may not be presented with things that we want to do, but everything happens for a reason, right? To help us get to where we want to go. And so I thought that that was really dope to hear and understand. Yeah.
And I think the thing is, we have this conversation a lot. Sometimes we'll look at something and it'll be like, is this boring? But it's not yes. a matter of being boring or not. It's what's the right audience, you know? And so,
yes.
Yeah, yes. Definitely was he hanging out with the crew that was like down with Disney Afternoon and thought that that was really like a cool thing? No, but it paid.
Right.
And it helped get him other opportunities. And so, yeah, that's the, and I think that when you go to art school, I think that one of the biggest things that people say is like, you know, fake it till you make it. And he definitely did that. but you could tell that he prepared himself for it. You know, he's a smart guy, figured it out, put himself in situations where he could get to the next step. But he still said he didn't feel like he was really on firm ground until he got that big Fox job. You know, so it's like,
right,
you never know when you're gonna arrive and what's gonna get you there.
Right, just keep going. If you're looking for a sign, I always say that. If you're looking for a sign, just keep going. Just keep going. Okay, so for the track that will be closing us out on today's episode, we have a really great song by alum Jacqueline Schreiber, class of 08, and her track is called Flown. Thank you all for listening and stay tuned for the next episode.
I'm going to fly out of here and go to bed. Goodbye.
Stumbling through the darkness, don't know what I'll find. Somewhere in this desert, left a troubled mind. With no sense of promise and nowhere to fly, I'll be back there someday in the by and by. But tonight they will find this bird. Left a troubled mind with no sense of promise and nowhere to fly. I'll be back there someday in the by and by.